But it's gospel. Nola nodded, not realizing how soon she'd need those words. It would be one of the most important lessons of her life.
I'm glad this is gonna work out,
Ms. Sable added. Just make sure it's okay with your dad.
58. Washington, D.C. Today. The bullet hit Houdini in the center of his esophagus. He was still in mid-chew, still grinning at Nola, as a small black bullet hole appeared in his neck. He tried clearing his throat. It was filled with blood. He grabbed his own neck, his body lurching backward against the sink in the kitchenette. It helped him keep his balance until his eyes went wide, then rolled backward too. His legs buckled. Nola knew what came next. He hit the linoleum like a discarded marionette, blood pouring from his throat.
Nola, are you nuts? Zig yelled. How could you?
The curtain spun backward, her claw no longer at Nola's neck as she elbowed Zig in the face, just like Nola gambled she would. Whoever the curtain was, she was a pro. Her top priority would always be self-preservation. It was a risk Nola had to take. If she didn't shoot Houdini, she and Zig would already be...
Phew!
Zig groaned, stumbling sideways, slipping on the shattered glass, blood pouring from his nose. The curtain didn't let up. Storming toward Zig, she sliced at his hand, her metal claws tearing his skin and sending his knife flying. But as the curtain was about to learn, there's a cost to turning your back on Nola. Without a breath of hesitation, Nola raised her gun, aimed it at the back of the curtain's head, and pulled the trigger. Blam! A tall panel of frosted glass, next to where the door used to be, shattered from the stray bullet. Nola was surprised by her own miss. The curtain was fast, especially for someone her size. Nola raised her gun again, same spot, back of the curtain's head. In a blur, the curtain spun with a roundhouse kick aimed at Nola's gun. Nola saw it coming, but she had to give the curtain credit. Whoever this woman was, she was a brawler. Well-trained, too. The roundhouse kick wasn't karate or taekwondo. Jeet Kune Do, Nola decided, noticing the way the curtain's legs swept like a hook. She was going for speed, not power. Not that it'd help the curtain here. Nola put up a blocking elbow. She had to use her shooting hand, had to move her gun. The curtain grinned, snapping her kick. Nola stood her ground, absorbing the impact and realizing half a second too late that the hook kick was just a distraction. A setup for the curtain to get close enough to... With a swipe of her hand, the curtain sank her metal claws deep into the inside of Nola's wrist, slicing it open. Nola made a noise, a groan, but she wouldn't cry out, even as the blood trickled toward her elbow. Dumb, Nola cursed herself. Should have seen that coming. In the distance, she heard the faint sound of sirens. The police were still blocks away. But as Nola felt her own heartbeat pulsing in her ears, she could hear everything. Like every noise in the universe was suddenly isolated and... There. Another sound. Coming from the front of the office. Someone sobbing. The receptionist was under her desk, crying. When the world sounds like this, Nola knew she was going into shock. Nola tried holding tight to her gun. Don't let it go. But the pain... Forget the pain. Put it away. She'd been in worse fights. She thought of Royal and the friends he brought home, the things they'd say. She'd put the pain of those nights away. She'd bury this too. Looking down, Nola clutched the gun with everything she had. But there was nothing in her hand. The gun had fallen to the floor. Barely 3 seconds had passed. Gripping her own bleeding wrist, Nola fought to stay on her feet. A few feet away, Zig was still on the ground, bleeding from his nose and finally getting his bearings. Barely 3 more seconds had passed. You have about 4 minutes before you pass out, the curtain said, picking up Nola's gun, admiring the weight. Approximately 6 minutes until you hemorrhage. Pressing her lips together, the curtain grinned at her own victory, then aimed the gun at Nola's chest and gripped the trigger. This is for making me drink that shitty coffee.
No! Sig screamed, fighting to get up. Blam!
Nola intentionally turned toward the bullet. Instead of hitting Nola in the chest, the bullet burrowed just below her collarbone. She was still clutching her own wrist, the blood seeping between her fingers as the world went blurry, then black. Her last thought was about the color of her own blood, and how it looked in this green fluorescent light. It gave the crimson a hint of purple. There was a color just like that on the color wheel. It was called Carmen, she finally remembered, as she fell to the floor, just shy of the conference table. Storming toward her, the curtain leaned down over Nola's unconscious body and pressed the barrel of the gun to the side of Nola's head. Her finger tightened around the trigger and... Ugh! The curtain roared in pain as Zig plunged his knife through her field jacket and deep into the back of the curtain's shoulder blade. The knife was halfway in when it hit bone. Zig gave it a sharp twist, widening the wound, which made the curtain drop her gun. It was a move he learned from the dozens of fallen service members who'd been ambushed in hand-to-hand attacks, and whose rounded gashes he'd stitched up so many times. Zig thought the pain would make her pass out. He couldn't be more wrong. You're fucking dead, the curtain boomed, still on her feet, her back to him as she thrashed and swung wildly. To protect himself, Zig had to let go of the knife, which was still in her shoulder. Thrusting her elbow, then a backward headbutt, she clipped him in the gut, then the chin. Her metal claw scratched at his leg. It was like he was standing behind a wild bull and trying to hold it in a headlock. Enough, Zig said, still directly behind her. His chest bumped into her back as he gripped her neck and dug his fingers above the hollow of her throat. The more he pressed into her larynx, the harder it was for her to breathe. The curtain gasped, still violently thrashing, still trying to stab him with her claw. He held his arms straight out to keep her away. Outside, in the distance, the sirens were getting louder. Zig squeezed even harder. The knife was still sticking out of the curtain's shoulder. She tried to reach for it, tried to grab at him. Zig tightened his grip as she shoved herself backward. Her ponytail hit Zig in the face. Zig squeezed even tighter. Within seconds, the curtain's movements slowed down, her arms sagging to her sides. No, not to her sides. She reached for something in her army coat, in the lower left pocket. A gun? Another claw? Tung. The round metal object hit the floor, rolling like a wobbly egg toward Nola's lifeless body. It was a grenade. Dangling from the curtain's middle finger was the pin. 59. Oh, shit. The curtain slumped sideways, nearly unconscious. The trigger, the metal lever on the side of the grenade, was at Zig's feet. No question. It was live. Oh, shit. Outside, the sirens were shrieking loudly. The police. If they ran in now... Nola, get up! Zig shouted. She didn't move. Didn't look like she was even breathing. She was turned on her side in a puddle of glass shards and blood, still lifelessly holding her own wrist. Zig dropped to his knees next to her, looking for a pulse. Her skin was gray, but her chest... She was breathing. He tried to lift her. There wasn't time. Back at Dover, grenade injuries were a regular occurrence. Once the pin was pulled and the trigger got loose, the delay fuse on a grenade was barely 5 seconds. 4, 3. The sirens were screaming. The police were pulling up. Behind Zig, someone was coughing. The curtain. She was awake, hunched over and down on all fours, air now filling her lungs. The knife was still sticking out of her back, reminding Zig of the sword in the stone. The curtain turned toward him. Now, she coughed, her dark eyes on Zig. We all die together. No, asshole, Zig said. Just you. Springing to his feet, he kicked the grenade back toward the curtain, then threw all of his weight onto the wide side of the conference table, tipping it toward himself and Nola. The table landed on its side with a chump. Zig gave it another tug, letting momentum do the rest. As the table flipped upside down and toward them, Zig pounced on Nola, covering her body with his own. The table slammed him from behind, sandwiching them together. Zig shut his eyes and started praying, the same prayer he'd been saying far too often lately. Magpie, I hope I'm wrong about the afterlife, because I really can't wait to see you. 2-1 Zig's final thought was a fleeting one, about how grenades work, by projecting bits of metal into vital organs, and hoping that if his body got sent to Dover, Louisa would be the one to embalm him rather than Will. Because Will was a jerk-off. Zig shut his eyes, holding tight to Nola and pressing his forehead against hers. And then, nothing. Silence. He gave it another few seconds. Still nothing. Opening his eyes, Zig glanced over his shoulder. From his angle down on the ground, the slanted table gave him only a small triangular view of the conference room, which was covered in glass. He shoved the table slightly so he... There, on the floor, right where he kicked it. The grenade. It was just sitting there, fully intact. Confused, Zig gave the heavy table a shove, pushing it aside. The curtain and Houdini, both of them, gone. Mother trucker, the grenade. It was fake. Dumb old man, he scolded himself. So stupid to fall for such an easy distraction. Along the floor, there was a trail of blood that led to the back of the office, past the kitchenette. There was a click as the fire door slapped shut. When the curtain left, she was carrying Houdini's body. Maybe Zig could still catch her. Certainly he could. But only if he left Nola. If Zig were smart, he'd run right now. Leave Nola to the cops. They'd get her the medical attention she needed. And they'd also start asking questions, which would cause a brand new set of problems. Zig thought back to the magic shop, to what the old magician Caesar had said about the big move covering the small one. Whatever Operation Blue Book was doing with those suitcases full of money, someone in the military was making really big moves to keep this all quiet. It was the same with... Who was that woman? The Native American. No rank, ribbons, or name tag on her army jacket. That's how Uncle Sam goes in when they don't want to risk being traced to a particular mission. If she's active military, big moves were definitely happening. That's why Colonel Sue, Master Guns, and everyone else at Dover were suddenly working double time to see why Zig was so interested in this case. So why was Zig so interested? He stared down at Nola on the ground, her head awkwardly sagging sideways. To the untrained eye, she looked like a corpse, but Zig knew. The dead have a stillness and weight that can't be replicated. Nola was alive, and if everyone on the other side was active military, there was only one way to keep her that way. "I got you," he whispered, scooping Nola into his arms. He grabbed her gun, too, just in case. As he lifted Nola, her white hair flowed away from her face, revealing the scarred and jagged edge of her left ear. Zig was embarrassed by how good it made him feel.
Get off me, Nola growled, her words slurring, her eyes still closed. I don't need your help.
Zig ignored her, eyeing the wound below her collarbone. Clean hit. Even if the bullet was still inside, that was good. Meant it could be stitched. The sirens outside were deafening. There was a screech of brakes. The cops were arriving. Zig headed toward the back door, cradling her as he kicked it open and darted out into the cold. He glanced around. The alley was wide, big enough for a truck, but completely empty. Thank God it was dark.
Mongol, Faber, Statler, Ticonderoga,
Nola mumbled. Ticonderoga? That a person or a place? Nola shook her head, blinking herself awake and wincing in pain.
You better be able to stitch me together, she muttered.
60. Caesar, we got problems. No one answered.
Caesar, get out here! I need help!
Zig shouted, bursting into the magic shop. He had left Nola lying across the back seat of his car, floating in and out of consciousness.
I need a first aid kit. And a sewing kit if you've got it.
Zig made it all the way to the front counter before he noticed the smell. The smell he knew so well from Dover. The coppery stench from when a body was still fresh. The smell of blood.
Caesar, if you're about to jump out wearing a gorilla mask, please do it
On Zig's right, down one of the aisles, he spotted a small dark puddle seeping from the foot of one of the bookcases, coming from the aisle behind it. Zig's chest felt like it was hollowed out with a metal rake. He ran to the next aisle. The puddle was larger there. At eye level, a shelf filled with bendable magic wands and rubbery pencils was sprayed with bits of meat and bone. The words "kids section" were handwritten on a laminated index card that was taped to the top. Along the floor, a long smear of blood ran down the aisle and turned the corner, like someone had dragged the body away, or was still dragging it. Zig reached into his pocket, putting his hand on Nola's gun. He was tempted to yell a warning, something to scare them off. But the truth was, whoever was here, Zig didn't want to scare them off. Cocking the gun and gripping the trigger, Zig walked quickly down the aisle, sticking to the left to keep himself off the overhead camera. On the opposite side of the store, the mounted Bozo the Clown head kept watch. The smear of blood across the tile veered around the corner, then beelined toward the store's back room, where the door was propped open. Zig looked up, eyeing the ceiling. He could still see the mounted Bozo the Clown. But unlike the front of the store, there were no cameras back here. Whatever business Caesar did in the back room, he didn't want records of it. More important, whoever was back there now, they wouldn't see Zig coming. On three, Zig told himself, pausing just outside the threshold. He held his breath and gripped the trigger. One. Two. Darting inside, Zig pointed his gun. The wide storage room was just as he had left it, stacks of cardboard boxes, egg crates filled with old magic tricks, but otherwise empty. Along the floor, the smear of blood veered to the left, to Caesar's tiny office. Sticking out of the open doorway were the legs of an old man dressed in slacks and orthopedic black shoes. No, 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 Zig muttered. Zig raced to the amazing Caesar's side. The back of his head was a wet mess of hair and exposed bone. He was face down in a pool of his own. The blood was everywhere. On his chair, on the handles of the desk drawers. There was even a perfect red handprint, like a kindergarten painting on the leather blotter on his desk. Caesar wasn't dragged here. He crawled on his own. At Dover, Zig had seen it dozens of times. On the battlefield, a soldier with a missing jaw and no legs, crawling 2 miles back to his base, just so he could die in his own bed. No one fights harder for life than the dying. Zig re-examined the blood on the chair, the desk, even the blotter. So what made Caesar crawl all the way here? Zig turned the body over. A spit bubble, tinted red with blood, popped at Caesar's lips. He was breathing. Caesar! Caesar, can you hear me? The old magician didn't move, though his eyes were still open, dilating in the light. His skin was gray, like an elephant. He didn't have long. Caesar, if you hear me, blink! He didn't blink. He just stared up at Zig, peaceful as could be. There was no fear on his face. He knew what was coming. Zig went to say something, then noticed. Caesar was clutching something in his hand. It was square and silver. A picture frame. He was holding it to his chest. This is what Caesar crawled back for. Who's this? This you? Zig asked, tugging on the frame. Caesar nodded with his eyes, but wouldn't let go. The frame was smeared in blood, but Zig could still make out the image. A muted color photograph from the 80s, of an elderly couple on a cruise ship. The man's hair was thicker and darker, but it was clearly Caesar, his arm draped around the woman's waist. It was the pose from every cruise ship photo, right down to them standing in front of a round life preserver with the name of the ship on it, SS Sea Dream. From the looks of it, Caesar was a bruiser back then, a rhino stuffed into a Hawaiian shirt. But God, the way his mouth was open in mid-laugh, did he look happy? Your wife? Zig asked, now picturing his own ex-wife, in a similar photo she and Zig took decades ago, on a riverboat in New Orleans for his 30th birthday. Would Zig crawl back through his house just to get one last look at the photo? He knew the answer.
The plane,
Caesar sputtered, his face ruled by sadness. That wasn't your fault. You couldn't have known. Caesar shook his head.
I knew he was.
He fought to get the words out.
Torture, Houdini was a shitbag.
This is because of me. I had you give him the bag. This is my fault, Caesar.
I'm so sorry.
Caesar shook his head again. He tried to say something, but the words wouldn't come. He looked angry now. No, not angry. Frustrated. Then irritated. Then terrified. Then full of despair. His emotions galloping. It reminded Zig of the hospital all those years ago. When someone's dying, their face betrays every thought, their filter gone, their eyes like a flipbook of passions and sentiments, each fully formed thought a bolt of electricity whistling through their synapses. On your deathbed, life may very well pass before your eyes, and so does your reaction to it. Caesar's breathing slowed. His skin was grayer, looking like putty, and then he started to smile. Began to laugh. Another bubble formed at Caesar's lips.
Before he shot me,
Caesar swallowed hard.
I saw it had GPS.
What had GPS? I don't understand.
Special forces. They all have. So they can track. I saw it on him when he took the bag,
the old magician insisted, reaching into his pocket. His hand was shaking as he pulled it out and revealed what would be his final magic trick. The item dangled from his crooked finger.
I stole the fucker's watch.
61. Homestead, Florida. 10 years ago. This was Nola when she was 16.
You're shitting me. A damn skunk?
Royal asked.
It's de-scented. He's like a cat.
It's a fucking skunk.
Look at him. It's like a cat. Like a cat,
Nola said, as the skunk did infinity loops around her legs, its tail lingering in the air.
I thought you liked cats,
Nola added. Royal did like cats. He'd never admit it, but Nola saw the way he'd kneel down and do kissy lips whenever their neighbor's pet, a fat and snooty ginger cat named Tubbs, sauntered into their front yard.
He's cute,
Royal blurted.
I know, right?
Royal was down on one knee, rubbing his fingers together to call the skunk close.
When I was little, I wanted a cat so bad,
he explained, the skunk now nuzzling against his fingers.
My mother would never let me have one.
What about your dad?
Royal looked up, flashing Nola a... She'd never seen this look before. More than sadness. There was sorrow on his face. Profound sorrow. That was the last time she'd ever asked Royal about his dad. They both turned back to the skunk.
Where will it poop?
Nola held up the litter box that Ms. Sable gave her.
In here. Like a cat,
Nola said for the fourth time.
His name is Dooch.
Royal eyed the litter box, then Dooch. He was unreadable, even to Nola.
I'm not calling him that.
You don't have to.
And I'm not saying we're keeping it.
Nola nodded far too excitedly.
But until we decide what's what, I've got kitty litter in the garage. In the bookcase by the hoop.
Why do you have kitty litter?
For the grease. Come on, I taught you that. It gets grease stains out of the driveway.
Nola took off for the garage, her sudden movement startling Dooch, whose rear end spiked in the air, armed with blanks. In the garage, Nola headed for the basketball hoop that Royal got as payment for a fake Canadian passport. It leaned on a rickety wire shelving unit that bent like a palm tree in a hurricane. Nola thought the kitty litter was on the lowest shelf. But when she got there, it was gone. Confused, she checked the other shelves, then checked below the brand new workbench Royal had just bought himself. She even checked behind the stolen stop sign that Royal had illegally taken down at the end of the block, since no way did they need a four-way stop there. What kind of dumbass rule is that? Still no kitty litter. Glancing around the garage, Nola noticed a few folding chairs and two $400 vacuum cleaners, another trade from an immigrant family, that were blocking the bottom shelves of the white particle board bookcase that Royal used to store industrial packs of laminating sheets. Maybe that was the bookcase he was talking about. With a tug, Nola pulled away the vacuum cleaners. There. Kitty litter. But as she stepped in to pull it off the lower shelf, her foot kicked the bookcase and... tunk. The toe kick of the bookcase fell forward. Nola knelt to pick it up. Behind it, though, in the narrow space behind the toe kick, there was something back there. Something hidden. Papers. No. Not papers, envelopes. A small stack of them. Nola pulled out the stack, which was covered in ancient dust and held together by a green rubber band. They were all addressed to Royal, but the handwriting... the return address. Nola's throat tightened, her windpipe feeling like it was filled with sand. B. LaPointe, Guidry, Texas. Barb LaPointe. Nola's old family. The ones who gave her away, gave her to Royal. Nola tore off the rubber band, flipping through the stack and scanning post dates. 9 years ago, 8 years ago, even one from 7 years ago. These were right after Nola left, after Royal took her. All these years, she thought the LaPointes abandoned her, but they were reaching out. They were writing. Nola's heart punched inside her chest like it was about to burst through her ribcage. Ripping open the first envelope, a bright red one like a valentine, Nola pulled out... it wasn't a card. It was a note, handwritten on white loose-leaf paper. Nola tried reading it, but her eyes, her brain, just seeing the tidy loops of Barb's old handwriting, everything was moving too fast. None of the words made sense. She started again. Dear Royal, so nice meeting you face to face... with such a difficult decision, we know you'll take care of Nola, but... but? Why was there a but? Realized we forgot to collect payment. Payment? Nola tore open the next letter. I'm sure it was just an oversight, but Christmas is coming, so if you could send a check... She tore open another. And another. And another. Each letter growing more insistent. Expect you to keep your promise, Royal. Check. Cash. Money. And that one word Barb used over and over. Payment. Nola's head was spinning, and her heart was deflated, sagging over her lungs, making it impossible to breathe. All these years, Nola thought the LaPointes gave her away so they could give her an improved life. So they were in a better position to help her brother. But now, to read these, they didn't just give her away. They sold her. And worse, Royal bought her. Like property. And apparently he thought so little of her he never even made the payment. Not that the LaPointes could tell that to anyone. All they had was Royal's word. They could never enforce an illegal agreement like that.
Nola, you find the cat litter or not? Royal called out, his voice close.
Nola stuffed the letters back into place, quickly closing the toe kick and sliding the vacuum cleaners back just like it was. But as she grabbed the kitty litter, behind her, there was a sharp creak of moving floorboards. Nola looked over her shoulder. The doorway was empty. Motes of dust floated in the air, but she could tell. Sometimes you just know. Royal had been standing there. Did he see? Did he know what she'd found? Nola had no idea until later that night when she decided that her best course of action was to go back and grab the old letters. She sat awake half the night, staring up at the ceiling, her new pet, Dooch, curled in a ball at her feet. Nola wasn't moving until she was sure Royal was asleep. At 2:30 a.m., she finally got out of bed, Dooch raising his head at full alert. Quietly as she could, she snuck back to the garage, pulled the vacuum cleaners aside, and once again kneeled at the toe kick. Wedging her fingers in there, she pulled the toe kick down, revealing Royal's secret hideaway. A ball of dust bunnies rolled toward her. But the letters, the proof of what he and the LaPointes had done, all of it was gone. Royal knew. He knew what she'd found. The only question now was, what was he planning as a punishment?
62. Maryland. Today. Tampons and nasal spray. Oh, and a water bottle. And scissors. And duct tape. That's what he needed. An hour ago, after tying a quick tourniquet in the car, Zig raced out of D.C., not stopping until he reached a small town called Mitchellville, Maryland. From there, he picked a CVS a few towns over, and the Mia Casa Motel, chosen because its rooms led out to an exterior walkway right next to the parking lot. Cradling Nola, Zig kicked open the door and was hit by the motel smell of stale cigarettes, sweat, and whatever that Rorschach-shaped stain on the carpet was. With Mia Casa's southwestern theme, every piece of furniture was blonde formica. As Zig pulled down the patchwork top sheets and carefully lowered Nola onto one of the sagging twin beds, she was still in and out of consciousness. At one point, she insisted she was fine, though she was clearly unaware that sudden blood loss caused a rush of the same hormones and endorphins that produce second winds during marathons. Within a minute, she was out cold. "Doesn't even look that bad. You can barely see it," Zig said, whispering the same lies he told all the fallen service members who came through Dover. Back in mortuary school, Zig's professor warned him not to keep speaking to the dead. "The closer you get, the harder it gets," as they say in the funeral industry. But for Zig, there was no other way. "I'm right here. You hear me? Right here," he said, cutting off her shirt to get a better look at the deep puncture wound below her clavicle. The blood was dark red. Good. The darker it was, the less likely it was coming fresh from an artery. Over the years, in the process of cleaning out and rebuilding over 2,000 fallen service members, Zig had become well-trained in every makeshift trick our medics use on the battlefield, and the results that came with them. Puncturing a water bottle with the scissors, he sprayed a jet stream at the wound. "Just cleaning it out. Best way to stop infection." Leaning in, he saw that the blood coming from her wound wasn't pumping in a steady heartbeat. It was oozing slowly. Even better. Meant her subclavian artery was intact. He checked the pulse in the radial arteries of both her wrists. Perfect match. Good sign. Blood pressure okay too. No signs of internal bleeding. "Lucky girl," he told Nola, who just lay there, unconscious. Gently, Zig turned her on her side to check her back. There were faded scars there. Old ones, crisscrossing up her spinal column. These were from years ago, when she was a kid. The only good news was at the top of her shoulder. No exit wound. The bullet was still inside her. Lucky for that, too. If the bullet had burst out, there'd be a far bigger and bloodier mess to deal with. Plus, with bits of bullet inside her, TSA is gonna love you at airport metal detectors, Zig said, tearing open the bag of tampons. This would be the hard part. Cutting a tampon in half, he sprayed it with the Afrin nasal spray, then aimed it directly at the soupy, bloody hole below Nola's collarbone. No anesthetic. Pain was coming. "If it helps, squeeze my fingers," he said, taking her limp hand in his own. "On 3, 2, 1. He shoved the tampon deep into Nola's wound. The tampon expanded, instantly absorbing, while the nasal spray did its job, tightening the blood vessels to prevent further bleeding. Nola's whole body shook, like she was jolted from a dream, her eyes still closed. Zig jumped back, so lost in the moment, so used to being around corpses, he forgot she was alive. In that moment, for the very first time and in the very worst way, it hit Zig that he'd become more accustomed to the dead than the living. It was a thought he wouldn't shake for days. Using his thumbs to stuff the rest of the tampon into place, he sealed the wound with duct tape, then turned his attention to treating and sealing more duct tape the cut on Nola's wrist. As he looked closer, he realized that wasn't the only cut there. "Oh, Nola, what did you do?" he muttered, eyeing at least three other faded pink scars across her wrist. Unlike the ones on her back, they all ran in the same direction. How old was she when she got these? 16? 17? There were so many questions he wanted to ask. About her, about the plane crash, about Operation Blue Book, and especially about Houdini. My God, she shot and killed Houdini! But as Zig moved her to the clean bed and pulled the covers up to her chin, one question stood out above all others. Why? Why the hell did that plane go down? Which, of course, led to what? What could possibly be so important about Nola that people were suddenly committing murder? Which naturally led to who? From his pocket, Zig pulled out the bulky military watch that the amazing Caesar had stolen from Houdini. Zig had seen watches like this before, back at Dover, on fallen Special Forces soldiers. The more macho the man, the bigger the watch. But big watches like this? Made by a company called Suunto. Special Forces loved Suuntos because they had built in MGRS, the Military Grid Reference System, which, like a high-octane GPS, allowed troops to input digital grid coordinates and find locations to within a few meters as they were moving through the theater of war. Efficient? Absolutely. Safe? That was the issue. Once something had GPS, everyone could learn where you... Oh, Caesar, you cruel old mastermind. Grabbing the landline from the nightstand, Zig started dialing Wags's number. Somewhere in this watch were coordinates. Coordinates that would show every place Houdini had been today. And also, presumably, every other place he'd visited in the last month. "Don't," a voice called out. Behind him, Nola fought to sit up in bed, her color pale. "Don't do it," she whispered. "Whoever you're calling, they'll know where we are." Zig kept dialing. "This is someone I trust." "You don't know that." He turned, still mid-dial. "What are you talking about?" Nola sat up, wearing just her bra. She glanced down at her duct tape bandage, eyeing it with approval.
"You're supposed to be a smart person, Mr. Zigareski. Have you really not noticed that everywhere you go, Houdini and his crew somehow always know you're coming?"
"That's not..."
"Back at Dover, they shipped out Camille's body before you could figure out what was happening. When you went to my old office, they were waiting for you there, too."
"They were waiting for you, not me."
"What about now? Back in the car, I heard you call 911. You said there was an old magician, Caesar. They killed him, didn't they? You called the paramedics so someone would find him. Don't be blind, Mr. Zigareski."
"I told you. Call me Zig."
"Stop with the bullshit charm and pay attention, Mr. Zigareski. Whatever dumb trap you were planning in that magic shop, Houdini knew. He came there with every intent to put a bullet in that old man's brain. The only thing that didn't go his way was that he thought he'd find you there, too."
With a clang, Zig hung up the phone. For a moment, he just stood there, staring down at the Suunto watch. Was Nola right? Only one way to find out. He held up the watch. "We still need to get someone who can read the grid coordinates in here."
"Give me the watch,"
Nola insisted. "What?
Give it to me. Now."
For the next 2 minutes, Nola held the Suunto like a stopwatch, clicking the chronograph buttons, the watch beeping like a droid. As Nola scrolled through its on-screen menu, Zig was hit by that same feeling every dad gets when their child grabs their phone or remote control and displays a clear superiority over new technology.
Get a pen, Nola said, still focused on the watch. Write this down.
Zig didn't move fast enough. Nola grabbed the Mikasa pen and matching pad of paper from the nightstand. Quickly jotting down some letters and a 10-digit number, she clicked back through the watch's menu, re-entering the digits. A map appeared on screen. There was another beep. Then Nola made a face.
What? What's it say?
Zig asked. She looked over at the notepad, then back at the watch, rechecking to make sure she had it right.
According to GPS, this is where Houdini was yesterday.
Is it some place we know?
I'd say you definitely know it. Based on the time. He landed there last night.
So it's an airport?
Not an airport.
I don't understand. Where do you land that's not an airport?
The one place where he clearly had a friend who could help him get inside. That's how Houdini stayed out of sight,
she said, holding up the watch toward Zig. Zig's eyes went wide. At the bottom of the screen were the letters D-E.
Delaware.
No, that can't be.
But it was. Houdini arrived last night. Hid there right under your nose, Nola explained.
On screen. Zig eyed the familiar outline on the map.
The mortuary. He was in your building, Mr. Zigarowski. At Dover Air Force Base.
63. In the man's ear, the phone rang three times. Voicemail. Annoyed, he hung up and dialed again. New number this time. Ring. 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 What are you doing? His associate hissed on the other line. This is my work line. You ignored my call on your cell phone, the man with the wood chipper of a voice said. Don't do that.
Will you get over yourself? You and Houdini told me to be smart. I'm being smart. Unless you want me picking up your call in front of half of Dover.
There was an announcement from the intercom. People bustled back and forth through the waiting area, most of them with their heads down, scrolling through their phones. It made the man think how much he hated the damn internet.
Where are you anyway?
Sounds like an airport, his associate said.
You promised an update,
the man with the wood chipper voice shot back. He had gray hair, the color of smoke, and kept his back to the crowd so no one could get a good look at the fleshy white scar that split his lower lip and ran down to his jaw.
I need to know where Zig is.
That's our first problem. I haven't heard from him in hours.
Then let me give you a hint. Houdini's dead. Zig and Nola are gone. You missed an entire firefight. We sent cleanup in, but it's still a hot damn mess.
You have no idea. Remember when you said your magician friend Caesar was all taken care of? He was more hardy than you thought.
He's alive, Woodchipper asked.
Not anymore.
But someone placed a 911 call. Everyone here's saying it sounds a lot like our friend Zig.
Did Caesar know anything about you?
The man with the woodchipper voice went silent.
Now boarding on track 29, the intercom announced overhead.
A small crowd of travelers surged for the gate marked track 29. The man with the woodchipper voice barely moved, gripping his phone, his back to them all.
Train station, huh?
What,
you don't like flying?
His associate was perceptive, even more than he thought.
Just do what we asked, the man growled. I know this isn't easy for you. But if you don't help us find Zig soon, we'll all be...
I know the damn consequences, okay? I'm on it. I'll call you back.
Without a word, the man with the woodchipper voice hung up the phone and headed for the train. He chose the silent car because, God, He'd had enough slobs barking into their cell phones, clueless to the volume of their own voices. As he finally found a seat, his own phone buzzed with a text message. 6 words. Spotted at a CVS in Maryland. A small grin twisted the fleshy white scar along the man's lip. With a few taps, he composed a new text message to a brand new recipient. We got him. 64. Zig gripped the corner of the motel's thick TV like he was using it to stand. What Nola said. Did he believe her? Did it make sense? Part of it did. Back at Dover, someone made sure the body was switched. Someone purposely rushed the wrong fingerprints and dental records through the system. Someone even knocked Zig out on the morning when the other bodies arrived. Houdini was a stranger, a fast-talking thug. No way could he pull all that off, not without help. Whoever snuck Houdini into our building. Zig paused, rerunning the logic. It could have been anyone. There are thousands of people on base. Nola didn't say anything, still focused on the watch. Don't give me that look. My friends, Dino, Master Guns, even Amy Wags. They wouldn't do that, Zig added, now pacing. It could have been anyone. Nola sat there in the bed, hitting buttons, the watch beeping. Colonel Sue. Her I'd believe, Zig continued, carefully watching Nola's reaction. But it's gotta be someone who knows about the ways we ID people. She still didn't say a word. Heading for the nightstand, Zig picked up the landline. Who are you calling? Nola challenged. He put the phone back down. He wasn't even sure. What do you want, Mr. Zigarowski? In alphabetical order? I want to know what the hell is going on. I want to know every single person who's chasing us. Who was that Native American woman? The one who shot you and tried to murder us? The Curtain. That's her name? The Curtain. That's what he called her. Never seen her until today. I'm guessing she's a hired gun. Hired by who? Nola went quiet, letting out a low, deep breath. Houdini. At just the name, Zig's brain flipped back to what Caesar said about Houdini's old blue book. About the 3 aliases on the plane. A small group that no one ever realized was there. Zig could feel the pieces starting to fit together at the far edges. But even so, the way Nola said his name, there was newfound anger in her voice. So you know him, Zig said. I didn't say that. You haven't said anything. In case you didn't notice, I saved your life. I didn't ask for your help. And yet, I still gave it. According to most dictionaries, that's called generosity, or kindness. Some might see it as stupidity, but I prefer something a bit more benevolent. Nola sat there, silent, now sketching something on the motel notepad. She didn't look mad. She looked lost in her thoughts. That's how you process, isn't it? By drawing, Zig asked. Still no response. I had a co-worker who used to do that. He'd have to draw a picture of how the deceased would eventually look before he could start working on them. Liar. You just made that up. Zig nodded. It was a lie. A white one. Designed to gain some trust. But once again, she'd seen right through it. He wanted to be annoyed. But he was actually impressed. Nola. If I were working against you, we wouldn't even be having this conversation right now. Back to silence. Back to her sketching. Okay, let's try it this way, Zig added. Let me tell you what I know. And then you sit there and draw whatever it is you're drawing and we'll see where it gets us. Okay. First, I know for sure you had a seat on a military plane in Alaska. I know. For sure, you didn't get on that plane. Maybe you saw something and had a quick thought. Maybe someone saw you and you took off. However it happened, you gave that seat to a woman named Camille. Maybe Camille was a longtime friend, or maybe someone you recently met. I told you, I didn't know her well. You knew her well enough to paint her portrait. Nola again went quiet. Regardless, from the way you came looking for Camille's body, you didn't know that plane was going down. Neither did Camille, until it was too late. And that also tells me, for sure, that Camille had some idea of what you were worried about, because during her last moments on a plane that was falling from the sky, Camille ate a sheet of paper with a warning message for you. So if all that's true, which I believe it is, that means that whatever brought you to Alaska, while you were there, you uncovered something. Something that I'm wagering is called Operation Blue Book. If I knew what Blue Book was, I wouldn't be hiding in a motel. But you know who Houdini is. Is he the one in charge? Nola shook her head. He's just a paying agent. A what? Paying agents. They make payments. That's the job. Payments to who? Depends what our government needs. Sometimes an army unit needs a hot tip. Other times we need a toilet paper contract so our troops can wipe. Usually, though, it's just quiet money. I have no idea what quiet money means. Still sketching, Nola explained years ago in Iraq, one of our tank drivers read his map wrong and mistakenly plowed over a farmer's herd of goats. Another time, our mortar men accidentally bombed the wrong building, sending bricks flying and injuring half a dozen innocents. When disasters like that happen, and they always happen, the paying agent comes in to make restitution with the locals. So he's a guy with cash. Again, that's the job. Most soldiers carry an M4 rifle. The paying agent carries a far more potent weapon, a briefcase full of money. He can make payments up to 30K, no questions asked. A supervisor can get him above that. To go above 100K, he needs to clear it with the Department of Defense. That's a lot of currency for one person. Consider it the cost for good PR. If we've got an army unit sneaking into town, the last thing we need is to call attention to ourselves. Or even worse, have some local farmer reveal our location while we're still in the initial stages of an operation. You can make a lot of peace with a lot of cash. So Houdini, his real name was Rowan Johansson. Okay, Rowan. He was one of these paying agents. One of the best. When a Humvee hits a farmer's handmade rock fence, you call for a paying agent. But when that Humvee hits something more valuable, you call Rowan. What's more valuable? Like hitting someone's house? Like killing someone's child, Nola said, looking up. Sig stood there, not blinking. She continued to stare, which Sig was starting to realize she did quite often. She had the wary eyes of an old woman, and they were always perfectly focused, picking life apart. Indeed, even now, as she talked about the death of someone's child, she turned that focus straight toward Sig, searching him for a reaction. For Sig, though, there wasn't one. Despite the loss of his daughter, he knew how life worked. He saw death all the time. Every week, he'd stand over a gurney, putting flesh makeup on a gray body, prepping yet another young soul who was cut down in his prime. I see it every day, he told her. No, you see it after the hurricane hits, Nola said. Imagine the moment itself. When a Sunni mom comes running down a dirt road, yelling in Arabic that our unit just left live ordnance around, which was found by her now-dead 5-year-old son. I couldn't understand the dialect, but I'll never forget that woman's screams. Anguish sounds the same worldwide. What's your point? You asked about Rowan Johansson. That's what he does. People are horrified when you put a price on a child's life. But in a small Sunni town, for a male child, which are valued there more than females, when you calculate lifespan, add the fact they can work until they're 80 years old, then compound it all as an annual salary, that dead boy will cost Uncle Sam about $72,000. Pay the poor family in cash and abracadabra, the problem goes away. She paused as she said the words. Now you understand why they call him Houdini. He makes the biggest mistakes. Disappear, Sig said, as Nola went back to sketching on her notepad. To Zig, the story made sense, and matched up even more with what he'd heard back at the magic shop. Houdini seemed to be spending a great deal of time moving cash, and lately, according to the amazing Caesar, appeared to be moving more of it than usual, including a big shipment from Alaska. Which begged the question, what was going on in Alaska that they had a sudden influx in cash? Did all the extra cash mean that someone was asking Houdini to cover up an even bigger problem? And more important, how'd this all tie in to Nola? That crashed airplane. And Operation Blue Book. Glancing over at Nola, Zig noticed the way she was holding her pen, like she was strangling it. Nola, if there's anything else you know, I know Houdini, like any special ops paying agent, specializes in disasters, especially the ones that the army doesn't want anyone to hear about. That's all I know. So could that be what Operation Blue Book is? Maybe that's why he was in Alaska. Maybe Blue Book isn't the process of making big things go away. Maybe instead of being a slush fund, Blue Book is its own private mission, and in the midst of it, they made a mistake that they now need to cover up. Still sketching, Nola didn't say anything. Or maybe someone accidentally found out that Houdini was covering Blue Book up. Or, Zig said, still letting the facts tumble through his brain, maybe when Houdini saw all the cash he was being sent, maybe he started taking his own private cut. Is that possible? How much did you say a paying agent carries around with him? More silence. You know, Nola, if you want to figure out what's going on, it might be helpful to actually speak to each other. She continued to sketch. Zig wanted to be mad, but he knew silence like that was trained into her. Zig cleared his throat and craned his neck, trying to get a look at what Nola was drawing. She turned away, just slightly, making it clear she wasn't sharing. Nola, if it makes you feel better, I figured out your art. That's what brought you to Alaska, right? I know why you went there. Nola glanced up, but not for long. She was about to say the word, liar. I saw them, Sig interrupted. In your office. All those portraits you painted. The canvases that were leaning against each other. There were dozens of them. Soldiers from the chest up. They're really beautiful when you look at them. But also pretty sad, Sig added, searching her face for a reaction. On the back of each one, I noticed you always listed the soldier's name. Daniel Graff, Monterey, California. Sergeant Denise Madigan, Kuwait. Nola's sketching slowed down. Not by much, but enough. Come on, Nola. All it took was an internet connection. Once I got pictures of them, did you really think I wouldn't figure out what all your paintings had in common? You don't know what your attempted suicide, Sig blurted. That's it, isn't it? Every artist in residence has her own motif. Years ago, during the wind down in Afghanistan, one of the artists used to just paint landscape scenes of our troops leaving the desert. Painting after painting of piles of computers we left behind,
holes where our HQs used to be, bulldozers that took our old bases apart. Other artists focused on people, painting soldiers in the field. But you, Daniel Graff, Sergeant Madigan, you paint those service members who tried to take their own lives. Nola sat there in the bed. She was no longer sketching.
65. Deutsch Air Base, Copper Center, Alaska. 5 days ago.
How much longer?
Camille asked. Soon, Nola said, a pastel crayon in her hand. Stop talking. Camille shifted in her seat, a plastic folding chair they took from the PX. Nola sat across from her, peeking out from behind her canvas every few seconds.
Come on, Sergeant Brown, can you at least tell me how I look?
Nola grunted, still trying to figure it out. She took another glance. Camille squinted when she talked, like she was always asking for a favor. That was the secret. Her flat nose was easy, but for Nola, nothing was right until she captured Camille's squint.
So this painting thing, you've done it with other people, yeah? People who tried to... who did what I...
Camille's voice trailed off. No one liked to say suicide.
You've met a lot of us, huh?
It's not a club, Nola shot back, using her finger to blend the beige pastel into the canvas.
The other people you've met, Sergeant Brown, how did they do? You know, after they...
Again, her voice trailed off. Nola usually despised small talk. But she liked this girl. Camille wasn't some self-hating cloud of doom. She was sharp, funny, even teased Nola for her subject matter, saying,
maybe next time you can paint something less depressing, like a sad clown series, a dead kitten collection, or still life with gun to head.
Even Nola grinned at that. What you've been through, Nola said. Think of it as life's second chance. She dabbed the pastel some more. Some people come back even stronger. Camille sat up straight. A second chance. She liked that.
I'm gonna be one of those people.
Nola nodded, cursing her pastels for not doing what they were told. She wouldn't be happy until she finished Camille's eyes.
So the army really pays you to paint?
Camille asked. I'm assigned. It's a mission.
Still, to draw like that. You're gonna make me immortal, huh?
Nola made a face.
I'm serious, Sergeant Brown. In 100 years, thanks to your art, I'll still exist.
66. Maryland. Today.
I'm right, aren't I?
Nola ignored the question. Sitting there on the motel's saggy bed, she was pretending to sketch.
You know I'm right. That's why you went to Alaska, isn't it?
Zig added.
Every morning at that base in Virginia, you'd come into your office and scour the nightly blotter reports from each base. Then one day you saw it in some outpost in Alaska, reports of a T-14.91, attempted suicide, and you went running. That's how you met Camille.
Nola still didn't reply.
Usually no one gave it much notice, Zig said. That's the artist's job, right? You come in, paint a few pictures, and leave. That's the job. Your boss told me back at your office. The army gives you the right to go wherever you want. But when you arrived in Alaska, maybe Camille told you something. Maybe you saw it yourself. Whatever happened, though, something just didn't seem right, did it? You realized it as you were going to leave. Something on that base was just a little bit off.
You don't know what you're talking about.
Actually, for the first time, I think I finally do,
Zig said, his voice now racing.
What'd you see out there, Nola? A crime? Or maybe just something that caught your eye, made you dig a little bit deeper? Either way, you realized what they were up to.
I still have no idea what they're up to. I don't know what Blue Book is.
But that's why you stayed. Look at the timeline. You met Camille and painted her picture. Your job was done. You had a seat on that plane and should have been on that flight that was leaving Alaska. But then you got that naughty feeling in your gut. It happened after you painted Camille. Maybe she said it while she was sitting for you. Something told you there was a better story if you stuck around, maybe a better painting even. All you had to do was stay. So at the very last minute, you got off the plane, gave your seat to Camille. I didn't give her anything. She begged me for it. But that's why you went to Alaska, isn't it? To paint Camille's portrait? She's the one who tried to kill herself.
I brought her joy. My painting, it made her happy. She loved it so much she begged me to keep it. Then she begged me again to take my spot on the plane. She was trying to see her fiancé.
And the next thing you know, just as you're starting to snoop around, the plane plummets from the sky. And now you realize your gut was right.
He paused, letting it sink in. Sitting in bed, Nola stared straight ahead, refusing to look at Zig, focusing on a peeling section of southwestern tribal pattern wallpaper. Her pen was still in her hand, but it wasn't anywhere near the pad of paper.
Nola, before you blame yourself...
Why'd you protect me before?
Nola blurted. Zig looked at her, confused.
Back in the insurance shop. With the grenade. When the curtain threw it, you jumped on me and tipped the table to protect us.
I thought you were unconscious.
I was awake,
she shot back, still staring straight ahead.
If that grenade went off...
The grenade wasn't real.
You didn't know that. If it went off, the shrapnel would have ripped through you. I'm asking you a question, Mr. Zigarowski. Why'd you risk yourself for me?
A long, weighty silence took the room. Zig stood there between the two twin beds. The air was so quiet he heard the running water through the pipes and the cycling of the toilet. He shrugged.
Why'd you do what you did at the campfire?
He took a deep breath.
It just seemed like the right thing. I didn't want you to get hurt.
Nola paused.
Is this about your daughter? Or me?
She asked. A new silence took hold. A far deeper silence as the air itself grew heavy and thick. It was the kind of silence that came not just from a lack of sound, but a lack of movement. In his ears, Zig heard a high-pitched hum, like in the embalming room. For a minute, Zig stood there, swaying just slightly. His voice was barely a murmur.
I don't know.
In the bed, Nola was still looking straight ahead, staring at nothing in particular.
Horatio,
she announced.
What?
That's him. He's the one,
Nola explained.
Back on the boat, I got his name. That's who Houdini reports to, the real string puller behind Operation Blue Book.
So he...
He's the one who hired the curtain, ordered the plane crash, and murdered Camille. They call him Horatio.
67.
Am I supposed to recognize that name?
Zig asked. Horatio, Nola repeated. It's the name of another magician.
Like a modern magician, or
from the 1800s, Nola said, climbing out of bed and standing there a moment to get her bearings. She blinked a few times, lightheaded from the blood loss. She headed for the bathroom, sat down, and peed with the door open. Zig looked away, though he still caught an unwanted glimpse of her in the mirror above one of the dressers.
So this Horatio, where's my gun? I saw you grab it, she said,
still in her underwear and a bra as she opened and shut the shower curtain, then stepped back into the room and did the same with the closet. She ran her fingers across the top shelf as well as the headboard of each bed. Then she opened every drawer in each of the two dressers. No one knows we're here, Zig insisted, eyeing the way her white hair ran down, covering the scars on her upper back. But it couldn't obscure all of them. She wasn't thin. She was muscular, like a boxer. And the way she was moving, favoring her left hand, she was working hard to hide it. But she was in pain. Where's my gun? I put it in the trunk of the car. Nola stared at him a moment, studying his face. Then she turned to the mattress, lifting it from the box spring. Underneath was her gun, exactly where Zig had hidden it. She shot Zig a look, and climbed back into bed. As she sat there Indian style, Zig couldn't avoid her underwear.
Maybe you could cover yourself up, he suggested. She didn't. Instead, she was focused on her gun, quickly field-stripping the pistol. Within seconds, she ejected the magazine and pulled off the slide and guide rod, then inspected the feed ramp and the grooves inside the barrel. "Can we please get back to Horatio?" Zig asked. During the Civil War, Horatio G. Cook was a well-known rope escapist, she explained, still working on the gun. So much so that his skills caught the attention of a man named Abraham Lincoln. "Is this for real? Look it up." President Lincoln was so impressed. He had two generals and a senator tie up young Horatio, who was just 18 at the time. When Horatio escaped, Lincoln made him an offer, asking him to personally work for Lincoln in the war. So he was Lincoln's spy? Officially, they called him a scout. But yes, Horatio was sneaky, a secret weapon, which is what Lincoln needed back then. Soon after, Horatio started working for the Union, and when he saved his scouting party from capture, he and Lincoln actually became friends. According to what I found online, on the night Abraham Lincoln was shot, Horatio Cook was one of the people in Ford's Theater, and one of the very few by Lincoln's bedside when the president died. I've never heard of this guy. Neither had I, Nola confessed, already done putting the gun back together. She racked the slide to make sure all was working. What makes the story even more memorable is that after Lincoln died, Horatio continued to do magic, continued to work for the government, and also turned his attention to exposing fake mediums. By the time he was an old man, he even befriended an up-and-coming magician named, "Don't say Harry Houdini." Nola was still staring down at the gun, like Zig wasn't even there. "I couldn't make this up if I wanted to." "So, in real life, you're telling me Houdini and Horatio were friends?" Zig asked. "Friends and fellow magicians. And from what I can tell, they both traveled around the country exposing anyone who claimed they could talk to the dead. Apparently, they both lost people close to them, and weren't ever able to move past it." Looking to his left, Zig studied his own warped reflection in the curve of the motel's old TV. "You said the real Horatio worked for Abraham Lincoln. Did the real Houdini have any connections to presidents?" Nola looked up from her gun. "He knew Teddy Roosevelt. Also met with Woodrow Wilson, too. Why?" "You said Horatio was Lincoln's secret weapon. Was Houdini one, too? So now the White House has an army of undercover magicians? You're watching too much History Channel. I'm not talking about an army. I'm talking about a single magician. Someone whose specialty is doing exactly what you said this guy Rowan Johnson, using the code name Houdini, was doing in the army. Making very big problems disappear." Nola thought about that. Zig did too. A century ago, the real Horatio and real Houdini spent quality time with the most powerful men in the world. And now, today, this modern Horatio and Houdini were using them as namesakes, moving loads of cash, and were ruthlessly determined to keep a lid on whatever was really going on in Alaska. Whatever they were up to, they were definitely covering. "The big move covers the small one," Zig blurted. Nola shot him a look. It's a magician saying," Zig explained, suddenly picturing President Orson Wallace barely 2 days ago, during his surprise visit to Dover, heading down the back of the plane and carrying the transfer case with his dead pal's remains. The whole world was watching Wallace, including every single person at Dover. But no one was watching the president's friend. "Abracadabra," Zig muttered, thinking about his visit to the magic shop. Pulling out his phone, he opened a browser and quickly typed three words into Google: Houdini and Nelson Rookstool. "The big move covers the small one," What if... Zig started speaking before he even had the full thought. Then he saw what popped up on screen. I don't believe it, he added, scrolling and trying to speed read. They have everything. His letters, his playbills, even his... He looked up at Nola. When Harry Houdini died, guess what government agency got all his books and papers? The Library of Congress. Wait, you knew that? Nola nodded. She'd looked it up days ago. He owned one of the largest libraries in the world on psychic phenomena, spiritualism, magic, Zig read from the site, and returning from the dead. There is no return from the dead, Nola said. Not literally. But think about it. We know one magician worked for Abraham Lincoln. From there, it sounds like the real Harry Houdini also did undercover work for the government. So if you were the president and you wanted to make sure no one found out about your favorite secret program, would you put it in the White House, the Pentagon? Or would you hide it in some lesser-watched government location where no one would ever look? Nola started sketching again as Zig stared down at the website for the Library of Congress. Maybe that's why Nelson Rookstuhl was on the plane. In fact, maybe that's why the president appointed him, Zig added, his voice at full speed. If the leader of the free world goes to Alaska, the whole world watches. But if the Librarian of Congress goes there, stay with Horatio. Just listen! Houdini!